The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The yen crashes and yields spike. And the Fed launches a big, fat trial balloon. Earnings are mixed. And we're waiting for the big boys next week. And we're listening today into the Outlook webinar we put on this week. All this and much more on episode number 767 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And welcome to another great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Here we are towards the end of October 2022. We saw options expiration. We saw markets get, well, thrashed around pretty significantly over the last week due to a lot of issues related to not only currencies, but of course related to yields and what is going on with earnings and the outlook and the economy and things that are really being pressured by the nonstop aggressive nature of the Fed. The thing that we are seeing right now is the attempt to break the economy in such a way that it slows it down to cause inflation to abate. Machiavellian, if you will, the ends justify the means. It doesn't matter how much damage is done, it seems. That's the signal they're giving us until what we saw on Friday. Really fascinating look into the minds and emotions and the insight of what's happening with the Fed. Now, last week, we had, of course, the Fed Insider on. We had a great discussion with Danielle DiMartino Booth and looking at what the Fed does and how they do it and some of the processes. Well, this week was very clear. And let me give you a quick glimpse into that for a moment. Before we do that, I want to mention we are actually going to provide you, which we haven't done ever before, the replay of a client webinar that we put on this week discussing what has gone on, the outlook, what we're looking to do with our various strategies, and what we see in terms of the actual outlook going not only for the rest of 2022, but into the future. So that's going to be coming up, and it's going to be in its entirety. We're going to go through that. But first, we have to talk about what happened as the week progressed and the yen continued on its significant march downward, hitting 150 yen per dollar. And then all of a sudden on Thursday evening, we saw it coming in more, 151, 151 and a half, 152. Markets said, you know what, enough of this. Yields were spiking. Things were getting crazy on the heels of the question about what's going to happen in the UK and, of course, the war in Russia and Ukraine. And it reached a crescendo sometime, I would say, about 6 a.m. in the morning on Friday, where things were just not looking great. And all of a sudden, 9 a.m. on the button, an article comes out in the Wall Street Journal talking about how the Fed is probably going to increase interest rates, as we expect, 75 basis points at the November 2nd meeting. However, they're now considering, well, maybe we'll see what happens and slow down our increase in the December meeting and throughout the next few meetings, really maybe even stop them in order to see how that reflects on the economy. Now, that's not a trial balloon that was sent up with the Fed whisperer in the Wall Street Journal right at the right time before the markets opened on a Friday with a concerning backdrop of a weekend coming and the yen getting crushed and the dollar moving higher and yields on the 10-year hitting 4.3 and the 2-year hitting 4.5 or maybe even a little higher than that on Friday morning. And all of a sudden they come in with this all out of nowhere, right? Everybody else, Bullard and Powell, and you look at what happened with Bostic and you see Kashkari, all these guys were talking about how, you know what, we're not going to stop our increases until we see the light in the eyes dimming from the inflation monster, right? That's what you got. And here we are all of a sudden on Friday when it's like, uh-oh, you know what? We may have gone too far. Maybe we should calm markets a bit. And it did. As soon as that came out, futures shot up at 9 a.m. in the morning on Friday. On top of that, we saw that yields started to flatten out, to come down, and the dollar started losing strength. Gold and silver started moving up. All the things you would expect if the Fed took their boot off of the neck of markets. And that's exactly what happened. Really kind of a fascinating look into what's gone on. On top of the fact that we have a lot of earnings coming out, this was really good for the banks again because the yield curve started to steepen again. The 2 to 10s looked a little bit better. And this is all the things that they need to do right now to, dare I say, here we go, I'm going to say it, dare I say, working on the initial groundwork for a pivot. The pivot. And that's important to recognize. That's what they're doing. The first stage of all this is to save the markets from themselves, from the fact that the trade that has been on to short the yen and long the dollar, or long the dollar, go long the dollar against any other currency, has been the trade. And where we are right now is in a pretty scary predicament that the Fed was worried about and saying, you know what, we're starting to see some bulging and breaking and things around the world. Maybe we need to just chill out a little bit. And that's what I read from what they did. So with that, we do have the winners. I'll announce it, I think, next week, the winners of the book giveaway, the 10 winners that I promised. And we'll send those out to you starting next week. What else? Earnings coming out next week. We got some of the technology. We got a mixed bag. Snap came out, of course, and just stunk it up, but good. We have Meta and all those companies really didn't react too well with that. But the big boys are starting to come out next week. And there is some hope that maybe the guidance that we've been seeing from analysts, not the guidance from the companies, the expectations or the analysts, their particular levels and consensus may be a little bit too pessimistic. And we may see a bit of a reaction that is positive, again, from an expectation standpoint, not that things are good, but an expectation standpoint that things may get a little bit better for the markets. And then you have the seasonality. That's what I've been talking about. I said, and I've been talking about this, and I'll put on record, you know, from about somewhere in the end of October, we should start to see things level off a little bit. And if things line up right, you could see a nice rally into the end of the year. And now we add that the Fed has softened their commentary a little bit. That could be very beneficial. We're still waiting to see if all the stars line up for that. It's not an absolute yet, and we're not going to go all in on that notion yet till we see some things play out a little bit before our eyes rather than take the jump beforehand. This just makes sense, right? You want to make sense. All right, so what are we going to do? I am going to provide you the full and unedited webinar that we did this week for clients, and the PowerPoint presentation that goes along with it is going to be on the show notes over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com, episode 787. So just go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You'll be able to download the PDF of that and follow along as we go through. This is about an hour, so this will be a bit of a longer podcast today, but I'm going to provide that for you. So I am going to come back at the end just to say goodbye and just wrap it all up. And we'll play that right now for your information, education, amusement. If you have any questions on this, you know where to find me over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. Ask Andrew. Here we go. The webinar from this week. Welcome right now. And here we are in October 2022. I'm Andrew Horowitz. This is the Horowitz & Company update and outlook. And we're going to talk about a variety of things that are going on in the markets right now. We're going to talk about any questions that you have as well. And there's a lot of things to talk about because things are not, well, shall we say, cooperating so well. The fact is that we are seeing a substantial amount of problems around the world, headwinds that are really throwing a serious curveball into asset allocation, investing, And while there has been a significant amount of reprieve over the last few days, the fact of the matter is it's still a pretty substantial year that has been, I would say, one out of 30. I've been doing this for a long time, and the fact of the matter is that when we look at what is going on with the markets right now, and in particular with various investment sectors, the truth of the matter is that I've only seen this really twice that it's doing what it's doing. But we'll talk about that. We'll get to your questions. We'll answer anything that you have. Hopefully you can all hear me well. We're going to have this recorded so it's available for replay as well, so we can talk through that as well. A couple things to note, just some quick ground rules and some things that we have to talk about is this. There is a Q&A box, a question and answer button that you can click. That's the preferred way to answer questions so it doesn't get lost in the chat. So if you go over to the Q&A button inside of the Zoom webinar bar, there's something that probably says Q&As or questions or something of that nature. Put in your questions there and we'll answer any of those that you have. The thing that we have to put on the screen right now is the disclosures that are required, that of course, anything that we talk about is for educational purpose only. Information is not a specific recommendation. And of course, investing involves risk, as we are well aware of. So we're looking at that as well. Bottom line here is that, you know, when we invest, we know there's a potential for loss. We all know that. That's the nature of what's going on, right? But then we have to look at it and say, okay, well, is it calculated level? What are we looking at the worst possible case scenario? And when we look at historical reference to all of that, we start to think about, well, what has happened in differing circumstances similar to today, where we may have a conflict in the Middle East or the conflict right now in Russia and Ukraine, where we have things that we can't quantify, like the continuation of the zero COVID policy in China. And what is that going to do? And how is that going to impact the global economy, which is a bit of an unknown, but we're starting to see some of the supply chain issues that are exacerbated and problematic with chips and the tariffs that go on and all the things that we could talk about with regard to inflation and a Fed that just won't give up, even though they've been consistently wrong. This is all the things that we try to put into the calculus of what we do. The problem is that there are those times, and like I said, I've only seen this, I think, once before, that basically all of the areas that you look at for the safety valves, the buffers, the protection mechanisms in a portfolio are just not doing well. And that is causing for portfolios to have excessive risk above and beyond the expected numbers. Now, you have to understand that while it's a problematic time, it's not the end of the world. I mean, we've gone through various cycles before. Those of you that have been clients for many, many years, and many of you have been, the fact is we've seen these kinds of times where, you know, well, things just aren't working well. We make interim changes like we did with our bond structure and the duration of our bonds in our portfolio not too long ago, where we did a while back and we continue to do. We have a tilt from growth to value. And the fact is that, you know, that helps a little. But still, what is going on right now due to currencies, interest rates, pandemics, we can go on and on, right? There's probably going to be some weather that comes up. But well, we saw some weather recently of the hurricane. I mean, it's really all these different things. And you may say, well, what's the point then? What am I even doing this for? Well, the point is because what is going on will pass. You know, and we have to look at this as a period of cycles, that the cycle extended too far in one direction for too long. And now it's just taking back a little bit. And then we'll go back on pace, what we call reversion to the mean. So I don't want you to have this paralyzing thought that we have this linear equation going on, this linear motion where it's just going continually in one direction forever. It doesn't do that. And it doesn't go up straight and stay there forever. And it doesn't go down straight and stay there forever. We don't see economies going into growth phase forever, even though there was some concept that was going to happen. And we don't see that, you know, going down forever either. It's a very defined process. The question is, how long are those cycles? How deep are those cycles? And then what happens on the other side? And as long as we have, you know, an understanding that this is part of a process, I think we're okay. Once we start getting outside of that, I think that's where the problems come in. Most of you that I've talked to understand this. So, you know, let's get to some of the things that are going on that I think are important to understand with regard to what's happening. Here's a general outline of what we're talking about and what we're going to talk about today. And some of the things that I wanted to focus in on. And I've tried to put this in the perspective of some of the things we've talked about before. The idea that we try to set up a portfolio reminiscent of a well-diversified flower garden that will have something that is at least going to be in bloom sometimes during the year. Whereas if we have one security or one flower, and that's the only thing, and we have a concentration risk that goes along with that, and then all of a sudden it's out of season and it looks terrible and there's nothing there, we don't want a portfolio looking like that. However, where are the problems that come in? Well, those once in every decade or maybe even 30, 40 year cycles that a hurricane comes and just wipes out the entire portfolio or garden, or at least does damage. The fact is, we're going to talk about exactly what's going on there because we have the Federal Reserve, we have inflation that's really causing problems, Russia's disruption of the energy, and of course, the weakness of other currencies against the U.S. dollar. That's a big issue. I think we have to talk about where do we go from here? You know, the idea of remaining diversified, is it a smart thing to do? Where are the other options, and are the roots justifiably still solid considering all that's gone on? Because one of the things that I think it's important to recognize is the idea that, you know, when we look at the portfolio, we look at our time frame, we look at the risk that goes on, you know, do we have a change when all of a sudden there is a significant amount of question? And we start to think, well, maybe we shouldn't be investing right now. We should just take it all out and go to cash. The fact is that that doesn't necessarily always work. The truth of the matter is that when we look at where we are with regard to the cycle and realize that you've been here before and you've gotten through it, and on the other side, usually we find a much better situation. That's where we are right now. And I want you to focus in on that with regard to where we are. So the truth of the matter is that we have a situation that right now there is a Federal Reserve that has become extremely aggressive. And their aggressiveness has caused us to, I think, have a lot more pain a lot more quickly than we should have. We are finding that the absolute path of them trying to correct a mistake that they made that was so severe that almost everybody else saw it but them. This idea that, well, inflation's transitory and, you know, not to worry, don't worry about it. Or better yet, let's go back further. You know what? We want a 2% inflation, but we're willing to overshoot for a while. We're willing to let it go hot for a while. And then we're willing to, in fact, not only do that, but go to inflation averaging just to allow for excessive amounts of growth in the economy during a period where, of course, it was questionable. That was during the 2020, 2021. And they do and made the mistake of what every Fed has done that I have seen in my career. They have gone too far for too long in one direction, believing their own nonsense to a point that they allow for excessive amounts of expansion or growth that has to be broken sometime in the future. And they do it to agree that's too hard, that causes too much pain in the economy, that they need to once again start all over again with the process of reducing rates and then allowing excess liquidity, pushing things up to a point eventually where it's obviously a very loose environment for finances. And that becomes good, right? We see a good market. So we see bonds come down in terms of yield, price goes back up. We see valuations of stocks go back up, commodities are back in favor, and then everything goes and does really well. The housing market slowly recovers, gets better. You know the routine. You've been there. Three times. One, two, three. I would say three times in the last 20 years, we've seen this general cycle. Now, the pandemic was a different circumstance altogether. We have to realize that there was a very significant amount of a situation there that was very different than all of this, right? That they had to come in and do something. We all questioned them. Did they, in fact, stay too long? Probably. Did they do too much? Probably. But inflation was not transitory on the other side for one reason in particular. And that was due to the fact of what was happening with a fiscal policy and the amount of money that was pushed out, whether it was PPP or whatever. Now, what the Fed believed was that the supply chain situation was a big cause of the inflation, and that really wasn't the case. If you look at the chart on the right, what we see that they're trying to make up for that, this mistake. We saw that they started raising rates right about here, right? Right about in the beginning of February, in the beginning of 2022, February or so. And then they've been on a nonstop pace higher. I mean, we're talking about now one of the biggest moves upward. It eclipsed the downward move that we saw right here. That was from, of course, the pandemic bailout, if you will. And they started buying bonds and buying bonds and buying bonds. And what happened was that it continued to move much higher for much longer. They held on. Now they're starting to sell the bonds or let them roll off a little bit right here. It's not doing a lot, though. So now what we have is an excessive amount of bonds that are on the books that they bought from the government with increasing interest rates because they're forcing that higher, causing the cost of debt, cost of financing the government to be much higher than it should be. And that's going to be a strain on the economy. And this is all being built in. We all know this. Nothing here is earth-shattering or groundbreaking, what I'm telling you about. The truth is that these are all part and parcel of the cycle. We see a cycle, and honestly, I just draw it very, it's just like this. You've seen the cycle. Sometimes it's deeper, sometimes it's not. It goes higher and it goes, you know, this is a cycle, the economic cycle, from peaks down to troughs and back again. And every time we think, oh my God, this is the worst time ever, it's not. It's all the same. There are a few differences this time that make it a little bit more difficult because of what's happening right here with the Treasury yields and the inversion of the yield curve. In particular, where we see the 10-year right at about 4%, ticking at about 4.1% today. But we have an inverted yield curve right here. And what does that mean? That means that probability of recession is baked in right now. What we have is a situation that the Fed is determined to break the back of inflation. And in doing so, they have to slow down the economy. Now, again, I think the Fed, which is a unchecked, non-public, or I should say they're not voted in, right? They're appointed. They're a politically positioned and fully autonomous organization that has no one to answer to, but yet can create money out of thin air. That is the job of a central bank, to be independent and to do so, has lost their marbles. They have gone way outside the skew of what is even reasonable for this position, which is basically to maintain maximum employment as well as price stability. They have gone way off the reservation. They believe that an interest rate cut can actually help certain components of the employment by race and by geography and by gender and by economic status. Think about that for a second. They think a blunt tool like an interest rate ability to move it up or down can actually pinpoint a specific sector of people. It's insane. I'm telling you, they've gone off their rocker. And Jay Powell has done an awful job, been terribly wrong leading us throughout this entire process, leading for all that's going on right now, and having now to really reverse everything that he said. And unfortunately, it's a problem. So all those wonderful gains that we probably shouldn't have had from 2020 due to the pandemic, those magical gains that happened, it was like, oh, that's great, are just being taken back a little bit right now. That's what's happening. The Fed funds rates by the end of the year, they're expected to be 4.5 to 4.75. And again, I'm stressing this point here. I think it's really important for us all to understand that what they are trying to do is provide a transmission mechanism through their communication strategy. Now, what is that? What does that even mean? What the Fed is determined to do under Ben Bernanke is create this transparency. And what the transparency really is a carrot that they put in front of our noses or a prod that they put on our backs. And what they're doing is trying to make us believe something by creating the image, the outward expectation of a particular outcome, and then pushing us to believe that so that we act a certain way. It is a form of economic brainwashing that then causes us to do things that maybe we weren't doing. So they're hurting us in a particular direction, saying, hey, we're going to keep on raising rates. Or better yet, let's look at it this way. During the pandemic, they said things like, hey, we're not raising rates. In fact, we're not thinking about raising rates. And that was a big issue. What that meant was that they were giving you the green light to pretty much realize that, hey, let's borrow money. Let's do what we got to do. They are not going to slow down this economy for any reason. Now, on the 180-degree opposite of what's going on right now. Right now, what's happening is that they're saying things like, hey, you know what? We're going to increase rates. We are going to look at this. We don't care about the stock market. You know, they're giving a lot of hints, a lot of background, but we're going to continue raising rates. And then they have each of the various Fed speakers come out on a regular basis and start talking about things like, hey, Neel Kashkari, just today, you know what? The Fed is still determined to raise interest rates in order to break the back of inflation. You see, Bostic, you see Powell, you see all of the names like Bullard come out and talk about each, like Bullard's a Friday afternoon bummer fest with Fed Speaker Bullard, where he comes out and talks about how interest rates have to go up for this reason or another. Well, they have fueled the idea that we're going to see by the end of the year 4.5 to 4.75. We're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of another two increases, probably 75 basis points November 2nd, and then one final 50 basis points, and then what? Already baked into the cake. Here's the fascinating part. This is really important. Already what's baked into the cake is that we are going to see a interest rate decrease, a decrease in the interest rate somewhere in the mid to late 2023, because the Fed is going to go too far, too fast, right now, and going to put the economy into recession to a point that they have to start backing off. So maybe what they're doing here is causing the slowdown to happen much more quickly than they should have, and maybe they could have gone a little bit more. But yet, what they're doing is banking a few percentage points and only to reduce down later. In other words, they're creating ammunition for themselves, for the ability for them to come in and do something if, in fact, they go too fast. Because the idea of going to a soft landing, which is essentially an increasing interest rate environment without a recession, is unlikely. In my opinion, at least, it's unlikely. They've talked about their willingness to sacrifice growth for price stability. That's a big issue. But again, I question, and I'm asking the question. I think it's a very worthwhile question. Or maybe I'm making a statement. Maybe that's better yet. Maybe they're wrong again. Maybe they've been wrong all this time. They've been wrong with their projections and their predictions for a very long time with regard to economic growth. They have to continually revise their numbers because they're so wrong almost all the time. And then what happens is now they come in and we're supposed to believe them at this point. Why is that the case? We're supposed to believe them that they're willing to sacrifice the markets, the economy, to rein in inflation, because inflation is a very destructive force. And we're sitting on a pretty high level of inflation right now, as is most countries around the world. This morning, the UK came in with a 10.1% year-over-year annual inflation rate, and that's pretty substantial. So a lot of things are happening trying to break this cycle of what's going on. They cannot afford to state anything other than the fact that they are on a mission that will not stop until they are successful. So that may or may not be true, is my point, but they can't say anything otherwise. I do think that they are going a little bit too fast. We're seeing a lot of things that are coming in already. But the fact is that what's happening right now is commodity pricing is significantly lower than it was at one point. We're seeing things roll over in the economy like housing and NEHB confidence. We're seeing manufacturing slow down a bit, employment holding out pretty strong, but a lot of other smaller components, the first things that would be affected by a slowdown that are deflationary are starting to show through right now. And that's really interesting. I think it's really important. Federal Reserve Chairman Powell has said recently, without price stability, the economy does not work for anyone. This is where the markets got spooked a little bit. The burdens of high inflation fall heaviest on those who are least able to bear them. So what happens is they raise interest rates and to fight inflation, because inflation on eggs and mayonnaise and cream cheese and on gasoline, on the basic fundamental things that are required in life, like rent, are going to hit the hardest. Who? Well, many of the people that are in the lowest income category, right? Because eggs going from $1 to $2 may hurt someone who earns $15,000, $20,000 a year a lot more than it would hurt somebody that makes $200,000 a year, right? That makes sense. So think about that, right? The core things that you need, which is food, energy, shelter, and travel, those things going up have a disproportionate amount of cost factor. The relationship of the cost of those moving up to a low income individual is much greater than a high income individual. And some of the low income individuals also may not just be people that, you know, are working but are not making a lot of money or working part time. It could also be retirees. So this is a big segment of the economy. However, the one thing they don't talk about and they don't really speak of is this idea of, hey, wait a second. What about the fact that with raising of interest rates, you're actually raising up the cost factors on a lot of places, people buying homes? You know, you look at what a higher interest rate does, and it really causes problems in a lot of areas that really bring up the cost factors initially to many, many people besides just the people who are in the lower income categories. So the higher interest rates are better for savers. So a lot of people are offset. The retirees that have a lot of money, maybe in cash, are getting a lot more. Right now, the Schwab account that we have for our global allocations, 2.9% on the value, on the treasury-backed money market that we have most of our cash in. We got, right now, you can get on a six-month treasury bill, you get 4.3% 6 months. And there is an opportunity, as cash not being just a 0% place to invest anymore. It's really interesting when I mentioned to a few of our clients, hey, you know, we're getting 2.8%. They're like, what? How are you getting 2.8%? This is just 10 years ago, we did the same thing and it was no big deal. All of a sudden now it's like a miracle, because we're so used to getting nothing on our money and having to push our money into alternative assets to make even, you know, a small amount of money. But the idea that pain is going to be brought to households, according to Jerome Powell, that's a big issue, again, that markets have been looking at. Now, here's the outlook. I'll go through this quickly. This is what we're seeing right now. And that is that over the next meeting, this is November 2nd, 96% chance of a 1% increase. Currently, we're at 3% to 325, going from 325 to 375 to 4. So it's a 75 or 3/4 of 1% increase. Okay, fine. Then we have the next meeting, December 14th. That's the last one of this year, right? There is a 66% chance that we're going to move up another 75 basis points. So actually, it's two. It's somewhere in this range right here. 100% chance that will be at least 50. And a 66% chance, you have to add these together, that there'll be 75 basis point move. Now we get into February of the following year, and all of a sudden we start to see a 53% chance of a 50 basis points, probably maybe just a quarter. And then we start slowing down dramatically, right? It stays that we're not going to be moving all the way here. And then you get to the other side of where the likelihood is, you start to price in the potential for a reduction. So that's kind of interesting with that. So, you know, when you look at the Federal Reserve and what they have, we call them blunt tools. We call the tools that they have blunt because, again, they have just a few things they could do. They could buy bonds by taking money from their right pocket, miraculously creating it, and then putting it into their left pocket, and then taking bonds that were created in the left pocket, put in the right pocket. And there you have quantitative easing. You're creating money, and what's happening is it's what are called sanitizing it. You're actually doing something with it. You're not just creating money and throwing it into the economy. You're buying bonds. You're giving to the government, who, of course, has a great knowledge of how to utilize your money best, don't they? No, I don't think so. Fact is, the government is one of the worst players when it comes to utilizing money in a way that is significantly, anything that the government does costs a lot more, spends a lot more time doing, and probably fails miserably and requires a lot more funds to do so. So their use of money is not probably the best use of money. But nonetheless, that's what we do. We give them money to spend on all sorts of programs and opportunities and things that, legal issues, et cetera. Right now, we are in this discussion about the Federal Reserve, of what has happened with regard to rates. Well, we've seen that this was this red line here, 12/30/2021. We had a somewhat normal curve. This is a normal curve, right? We have the low end here, down here, and then it goes up and something like that. That's a normal curve. It could do a lot of little things like this. Point is that on this side is lower than this side. Well, here we have this wonky curve. I don't even know what it's called. It's a modified, weird, inverted curve. It's inverted. There's no question about that, right? Which means, look here, this is the 1 year through the 5 year or so, is higher than the 30 year. This means that it's not a great time for the economy. Banks don't want to lend in these circumstances, or at least they want to pull back a bit. The situation that we have right now is this is a slowdown curve. If this is somewhat normal, even though that was the beginning of this year, and they have this is a growth curve. This is normal. This is a slowdown curve. So remember that when we look at this, and that we see that the spread, and you see where this was, 2000 red. You see that red line right here, where it turns red here, here, and here, right there a little bit. We saw that in 2019, we saw the inversion of the yield curve from the 2 to the 10, meaning the 2, let's go to the left side here again, the 2-year minus the 10-year. And right now we can say this 2-year is higher than the 10-year. The 2-year here was lower than the 10-year. So when we see this 2021, it was somewhere over here. Now we're here, an inverted yield curve, where the 2-year is higher than the 10-year, meaning that it is not a normal curve. It is a slowdown curve. It is a way that the Fed will suck money out of the economy, essentially. Now, what's happening right now, when we look at the inflation rate and the supply chain, this has actually softened up a bit. The problems that we saw over the last couple of years through the pandemic, through most of 2021, where you just couldn't get stuff. And if you did, it was a real problem. Right now, we can get stuff, but now there's a tariff put on, which I don't know, by the way, why we still have tariffs on things. It seems mind-boggling that during the Trump administration, when tariffs were put on, the Democrats went absolutely bonkers, ballistic, freaking out over these tariffs. And now that the Democrats hold a majority and the House, the majority and the White House, we still have a lot of these tariffs on, which are highly inflationary. I have said that from the day they were put on. What are we doing here? This is going to cause a lot of inflationary concerns. And everybody's like, no, look at that. No, no inflation. There was no inflation because we had a pandemic. When you add the fact that we have tariffs, excess money pushed into the system, low interest rates for too long, you have a situation where you have inflation based on tariffs. But right now what we have is a situation where we have inflation continuing to run hotter, but slowing, not as fast as the Fed would. The PPI, again, 8.5 year-over-year. That's the producer price index, the wholesale inflation numbers. CPI, the stuff that you and I pay, right, is up 8.22% over the year-over-year. In Europe, not so bad over here. If you look at this big energy problem they have here over there, the PPI is up 29% year-over-year. CPI is 10%. The big issue right now that we're contending with and questioning how long this will last is this is COVID that continues on, right? That who would have thought here we are, October 2022, that we would still be talking about this thing, that this pandemic that was supposed to be over in Easter of 2020, that's what we were first told, right? Trump got up there and said, hey, you know what? This thing is going to be eradicated. No big deal. It's not. And we had one or two. And then it was, oh, it was bad. But you know what? April. And then it was like, okay, well, the summer. And then it was not going to be that. It's going to be, oh, by the time, you know, the new year rolls around. And then it goes on and on and on. The fact is that it's still here. It's still a problem. We don't have the shutdowns and the problems that we have from an economic standpoint, aside from the work from home, the partial and hybrid work environment that we have right now, and the excuse to go along with that, the, in my opinion, productivity that suffers from that, and the cost factor expense that has increased dramatically due to all of that. What we have, though, is a situation in China that is just not going to get any better because they have this zero COVID policy, which is never going to allow for them to have a normal operational economy or at least a normal operational situation because they're going to be constantly fighting this thing. They're going to shut down Shenzhen and Shanghai and Chengdu and Beijing. This is a big problem. The problem with regard to how they are dealing with this is not helping the supply chains. And then on top of that, the chip issues that we have going on right now. The good news is that the cost factors associated with this, because the supply chains have opened up so significantly, better than they were, the cost factors to transport have basically been cut in half over the last year. We're back to almost pre-COVID shipping costs for many goods. That's going to help dramatically. That's a big factor when it came to cost factors. But we've seen unbelievable swings in actual costs over the last number of years, and particularly in 2021, just on the reopening. So the combination of the reopening plus this flood of fiscal stimulus or monetary stimulus in the system created this incredible 1-2 punch when it came to the world, when it came to inflation. And what we have now is a situation where that's all reversing dramatically, whether it's because of the Fed or because we have enough that we need, whether it's because the supply chain has been straightened out very significantly, where we find alternative place to get it. A lot of reasons why this happens, but wheat was over 100% up last year. And that was due to some of the war in Ukraine, a very big supplier of the world's grains and wheat. Aluminum was up 94%, not anymore. Corn was up 65%, not anymore either. So there's a lot of things that are straightening out, and that's really good. That's helping this whole argument that inflation is not transitory, but it's going to slow down a bit. Prices will stay high for a while, but the fact is the Fed can take their foot off of the, or they can take the sledgehammer off of the markets and the black cloud that's going on. Here's the global inflation trend. You can see where we are in the U.S. Is this blue line. I'll highlight this a bit right here. This is the U.S. You can see it's starting to roll over a little bit, which is nice to see, versus what we're seeing in Japan and Germany. Look at this. Germany continues to move higher. Even Japan is starting to move up a little bit here. China has been flat forever. Now, whether or not we trust their numbers is a different story entirely, but we are seeing that they are moving up as well. So we are seeing a little bit of a break in this inflation battle going on right now. Commodity trends are what I was talking about before, and I think it's really important to look at this. We see things like the price of aluminum, right? Spiking, coming way down right now. This is our aluminum. So it's spiked up 100%. It's up 20% since December 2020. Not the worst thing in the world. We're actually seeing the interesting things, the things that weren't supposed to be going down, the things that were supposed to be protective measures in inflation. Right? Eco 101, what did you learn? If we have higher prices due to inflation, some of the things to buy are hard assets, commodities. Gold and silver are great hedges against inflation. You've heard that, right? I mean, if I didn't hear that once, I've heard it 1,000 times. And historically, that's been the case. Not this year. And that's what I was talking about earlier, that things are a little bit in the upside down. If you ever watch Stranger Things, we're in the upside down where, look at this. Our green line here is silver. Since December 2020, down about 30%. Gold, down about 18%. And meanwhile, we have cattle costs that are up and meat prices are up. Poultry prices up again because of this is a different situation, but poultry prices due to the avian flu that's going on and the culling that's having to happen right now. But that all resolves itself. That all does. We saw the chicken in the store was $6, $7 a pound. The cheapest you could find it anywhere, depending on where you live. I saw it for $7 a pound. I thought that was absurd. It's back to $3 a pound for chicken breasts again. So this is all starting to roll over a bit, starting to get a little bit better, starting to, I think, slow down and seemingly start to see that rollover that we saw right about here. Now, is it going to just go like this? No. But I think that we're going to start to see this slowly but surely, because there's going to be a lot of things that are happening around the world, and particularly U.S. with these higher interest rates. It's inevitable. It may take a little bit longer. I think the Fed is going too fast right now. So be it. I'm not in control, so it doesn't matter. Right? But the truth is that I think that as much as we saw this spike go up here from really from February 2021, and that was another move, the war that we saw, this secondary spike on a lot of things, is all because of energy in the UK and in Germany and in Europe. I think that's going to start rolling over as well. You know, we saw this big rollover right here for Canada, right there. This Canada straight up, and then it rolled down right here. So there is some things that are happening to the beneficial side. Now, Russia, that's a big issue, something we really need to focus in on, talk about, because today there was a news item that they the four regions that they annexed on their own without any kind of say by anybody else in approval or even recognition of the fact that they can do so. So nobody said they could do it. They said, hey, you know what? Those four areas, they're ours. We own them. Thank you very much. Have a nice day. Well, they created a martial law decree on those four annexed areas today, meaning that, you know, if you do something they don't like, it's martial law, and we know what that's all about. The fact is that they are trying to really take control of those particular areas. I don't know, and I have tried. I've had a lot of talks with colleagues and people that are very much in the know, a lot smarter than I am, and the fact is none of us can get to the bottom line of what's the point of all this? Where are they going? What is he doing? Why is he doing this? You know, and what's the end game? Really, the end game is the important issue that we don't really understand in terms of, you know, where does this go? It could disappear tomorrow. You could just say, you know what? I got my four regions. They're annexed. That's great. I'm happy. Let's move on. This can go on a lot longer. But natural gas prices are a big problem. Right now, as we sit here, the price here, if anybody has natural gas in their house, you've been complaining about, oh, this price has gone up pretty well. Nothing compared to what's gone on in Europe. Look at the prices that we're seeing on the right-hand side of this chart right here. You can see that there was a significant increase, you know, inflationary move into July of 2021. It went up. It was like $30 per, right? Well, here we're paying like 8, 6, 5. You know, it went up a little bit, but not a big deal. Big natural gas producer we are. Well, in their infinite wisdom, Europe, and particularly Germany and France, decided, you know, a couple of things. You know, we want to go green. It's important to be green. And nuclear energy, no good. We don't want to be a nuclear energy because it's not green. We don't like it, which is totally a farce. Fact is, it's clean. Let's not get through that whole discussion here. But they shut down a lot of these things. They tried to go green, but they did one thing that was really stupid. They pinned their reliance on any of the old dirty stuff on places like Russia. Oh, now Russia decides, wait a minute, you don't like the fact that we're attacking Ukraine? Okay, no problem. You're putting sanctions on us? No problem. You're just not going to get any natural gas from us. Prices for natural gas have skyrocketed. Look back here, November 2020, sub 10. You think that the sub 10 that we both saw here and in Europe was a lot back then? But now we're at sub 10 here. There, $60. We're talking about a 6x increase, or actually a 10x increase in cost for natural gas. And they have a big reliance on natural gas, as well as it's not only that, it's also heating oil from that region as well. So they're really concerned about this winter. We're trying to get as much natural gas into the storage tanks over there, but they just don't have the capability or the capacity to hold enough that they need to get them through the winter. That's a big problem, not only for individuals, but also for factories, manufacturing, et cetera. So big problems when it comes to that. And again, they have things that have happened, like this crazy bursting. Something went on with the Nord Stream pipeline. Was it an act of terrorism? And if so, who did it? We can have our ideas of who did it, but the truth is that it's very questionable right now. There's even assertion that the U.S. did it. Possible? I don't know. President Biden said they would, you know, if they attacked, we would stop this whole thing. Not, you know, we would put the kibosh on the Nord Stream pipeline. I don't know. It's also a difficult product to export. You know, you have to put in a liquefied LNG form to transport. Very expensive to do so. So then the shipping rates really just starting to decline, as we talked about. So this is why this is starting to come down, because it's possibly with the shipping rates right here. So big problems for them in that area. I still think that, you know, when we resolve, you're going to see this come, you know, straight down here, especially because a lot of things are being done right now to go back to the old dirty, stinky things like coal and keeping nuclear. It was an announcement that two of the nuclear plants in Germany will be left open through at least April 2023. As I mentioned earlier, and I'll mention it again, if you have any questions, please do me a favor. There's somewhere down there or over here, maybe right over here. There is a box that says Q&A. You can put your questions in there. We'll try to get to all of them and answer any questions you have. We have a few that are lined up right now. So you can just ask the questions and I'll do my best to answer those. The U.S. dollar has been a big issue, and there's a few things you really need to focus in on that. The rising rates has created a strong dollar due to the fact that there's a correlation there. I was very surprised at the extent of the rate hikes, and we have some things that are non-dollar denominated that are hurting our portfolios on the global allocations on Investology. We have a mix of some of our foreign bonds in hedged and unhedged, and clearly the unhedged are getting hurt more because they're down primarily not so much due to the rate hikes, which is part of it, but that's the normal levels or somewhat from where we were that you would expect plus. So it's not, they're down more than you would expect because rates have come up a lot stronger. However, on the unhedged portion, they're down probably another anywhere from 6 to 8%, 9%, or it could be 10% in some in certain areas. And subsets of the holdings, we don't hold a lot of them, but it's enough to be an extra, you know, 1% loss on the portfolio extra, which again is not pleasant when we're seeing the problems that we've seen so far. So this rising dollar has been very problematic with regard to a lot of assets. We're going to see that multinationals, many of those that will be reporting over the next few weeks, are going to see probably a lot of discussion in the conference calls about what is going on with regard to their currency exposure and how that headwind has in fact hurt their earnings. You're going to hear things like constant currency, we did this or that, we were fine, but yet, you know, in currency terms, we're taking a loss X dollars. Inflation is oftentimes dollar weakening, but because of the rate hikes that are going on right now, and because of the push that we're seeing and how we are a lot stronger with regard to our hiking compared to the rest of the world, particularly, you know, don't we see it? So today, the yen's at like 149.7, almost at 150, which is a time when probably the Japanese, the Bank of Japan, is going to intervene. We've seen some little spots of intervention already over the last few days, but they can't stop this. This is what we call the Widowmakers trade, which is trying to go long the yen against the dollar. More people have busted out on that trade than there probably has been a trade ever. The government likes to have a weak yen, and they're doing so. What a time to visit Europe. What a time to visit Japan when the dollar is as strong as it is and the currency on the other side is so weak. Imports are very cheap. The problem is going to be that exports, what we export to other countries, get much more expensive. And as such, that is going to be another headwind and has been. And that's why markets are reacting the way they are. Earnings haven't come down yet, but markets are reacting like they have. And that's because of a lot of the things that we're seeing that are expected to happen. Markets are all based on expectations, either expectations that are realized or unrealized. It's important to understand that how far we go from the center of that expectation is how much we are miserable or happy. Okay. You know, it's like if you take a test in school and you think you did okay, but you get back your test result. You know, you thought you were going to get somewhere, you know, your passing grade of 75. You didn't feel great about it. You didn't feel too bad about it. But all of a sudden you get an F. You get a 42 on this test. You're like, you feel terrible about it. Or you get back your test and you got like a 93. You're like, oh my God, that's unbelievable. Versus if you get it back and you got a 78, you're like, okay, that's what I expected. The emotions, the way that you react to all this is exactly how markets react to the expectations that are either realized or unrealized and how far from the center that is. It's important to recognize that right now we are putting out a very severe expectation that we're going to see downside. Example would be what happened with Netflix today. The expectation was that over the last several quarters, the slowdown in streaming services, the potential for people laying off, going to other services, whether it's Disney Plus or Amazon or Hulu or name which one ever it is, Paramount, that was really going to continue to hurt Netflix. And guiding on, analysts guiding on where they thought things were going to be, they come out with a number today, blew the doors off, stock was off to the races, great time, hallelujah. Okay, that's great. Again, right now, a lot of negative is being priced into the markets. And what we saw last week with the banks, for example, is things aren't as bad as analysts are expecting. So that was good. Things worked out better. Right now, inflation has been just as bad as everybody's thinking. So nobody's thinking anything other than the fact that the Fed's going to continue raising rates. Talk about that a lot because that's a big point of contention when it comes to markets. When it comes to where people are going to place their money, that's a big issue. So I think I really want to focus in on this one thing because I want to share where to now. What are we going to do now? What's happening? How are we going to deal with this? So I've been doing this a long time. Not drinking this. I've been doing this business. I've been drinking this a while. I've been in this business a long time. And I can tell you that this has been one of the most difficult years to figure out exactly where the right place was to be. And I'll tell you why. Because essentially, there was no right place to be. And you say, well, Andrew, hey, you could have been out of the market. Yes, that's great. Then the question is, when do you get back in? And you said, well, so far, so good. If you weren't in the market, you wouldn't have these losses. Okay, that's great. You know, let's think about during the pandemic, if we happen to say, wow, there's a pandemic coming. And you know what? Let's take everything out of the market. Let's take everything out of every investment. Let's sit in cash. Be great. Okay, that's great. Then all of a sudden, the markets come down. You're like, oh, genius. Great move. When you start investing back in and how do you do it and how do you really gather all the upside that you may have missed out on? You do it when the trend gets above the 50-day moving average or some other metric. You say, well, when the Fed really reduced rates two or three times or when the pandemic's over. How about when things reopened? How about that? The fact is it was so quick, you would have never hit it. Same thing back in 2002, when President Trump was elected. Everybody thought it was going to hell in a handbasket. It was off to the races. That is not the way you invest. It's time in the market, not timing of the market. That makes the most sense long-term. The greatest way to create wealth is to be invested in high-quality assets over a long period of time through many different cycles. That means something very important right here, that there are going to be times that it absolutely sucks to be invested. I'm being honest with you. It means that there's going to be times you're going to be like, oh, this is awful. What did I do this for? Why am I doing this? But think about all the money that you made over the years and the risk that you took to get there. And I know some of you are saying, well, I'm getting older and maybe it's not such a great time. Maybe I should just pull it all out and just get that 2.5-3% that I can get in money markets right now. Okay, great. But you know what? You're still going backwards inflation-wise probably for a while to come. This particular chart, what I want to show you, I think is really important. This is not an excuse. It's not a way to say, okay, not so bad. I just want to show you something that I think is really important to look at. And that is We are seeing correlations that are very high right now. Correlations, meaning that asset classes, and I have another slide to show you that's really interesting, asset classes that are moving together. Everything is moving, gold, silver, bonds, stock, everything's moving together. What's not moving together? I mean, the only thing that really has been beneficial this year is like energy. Energy's actually been a good trade this year. The fact is that you could buy, you know, oil and gas and you made some money on that. Some of the energy stocks, some of the defense stocks, not so bad either. Pretty much it. That's about all you got in there. But check this out. This particular table here to the right here. Oops, no, that's not good. That's not a good drawing. Let's do it again. This table right here. Let's zoom in on that table, shall we? I'm going to go right here. What this looks at is the historical return of investments in a 60-40 portfolio, 60 stocks, 40 bonds over the years. And you can see that in 1931, that's right here, right? 1931, down 27%. Great crash, right? But let's fast forward 1937. There were some other things going on there. Not so good. You can see usually after these bad years, it's big returns the following few years, right? Anytime there's a really bad year, you get some really good returns. Sometimes it takes a little while. But I want to show you something. Let's back it up. 2008. This is the other time that I really remember in my career. Because we can go back, look, all the way. My career started over here, right? 85. So I really didn't see anything too terrible all these years until right here. So the only time that I really recall seeing in my career, even in 74, I was around for that. That was a pretty bad time. That was a big, big inflationary time. But yet, still, we're not seeing the 21.5% negative return like we're seeing now. Pretty terrible overall. What does that mean? Why is that? What is that saying? What is that saying is nothing's working. It's an anomaly this year. It happens a couple of times in history. You know, if we can count since 1928, a lot of things happened since 1928. Right? A lot of things. We've had wars. A few wars. Some big ones, some small ones. But we've had wars. We've had inflation. We've had deflation. We've had terrorist attacks. The list goes on. We've had pandemics. We've had dot-com crashes. We've had currency explosions around the world. The Asian currency crisis. We've had a hedge fund blowing up that just ruins everything. Big market crash, 87. We can go on and on with all sorts of things that happen. But again, look at this. We're talking about over 10%. Let's just go down the list. Let's check it off. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. 6 years out of 80. 6 years out of 80 have been over 10%. With a 60-40 portfolio combining treasuries, 10-year treasury, and S&P 500. And here we are smack dab in the middle of it. And you're wondering, why is my portfolio not doing so well? Here it is right here. Nothing's working. In fact, as I mentioned, that it's really important that these correlations remain high. There's a lot of emotions that are going on in the shoot first, sell first, ask questions later going on right now. The bottom line is remaining diversified is a smart thing to do. The garden is definitely damaged, but the roots are intact. There's no question in my mind about that. We make changes in the interim to adjust, and we're probably going to have a rebalance coming on in the next, by the end of the year, I would say. Depends on how things go. We're waiting patiently to rebalance. We're being very patient here. I got a lot of portfolios on my desk that have a lot of markup on them, but we're not doing anything right now. We're waiting for things to just calm down a little bit. We have this value tilt in the portfolio. Somebody's asking, actually, I'll get to that right now. Is it wise to have some exposure to the defensive sector? And that's a question that came in the Q&A. And that's inside of here. It's small enough, but it's exposure to defense and energy and things like that. Our bonds are now skewed in the short and have been skewed to the short end. So not the 10-year necessarily that you're seeing here, but more so on the I would say 2 to 7 year, and cash starting to pay. So that's a potentially viable asset category. Very quickly, not to give you too much of a squeeze on the brain here, But let me show you what to look at here. So just bear with me for a second, okay? So what I want you to look at is just this column here. This column here. Right, all the way down. Okay, we're gonna look at that column. So when we look at this, we say correlations. How does one asset class react when I compare it to another? In other words, is everything moving the same? Is it moving differently? If one moves down, does the other one move down too? Does the other one move up? When you have a one-to-one correlation, it's equivalent, meaning when it moves up, the other one moves up. When it moves down, the other one moves down. Here we are, the S&P and the S&P. So what's the correlation on the S&P? Well, it's one, right? So here, correlation, two hands, 100%, moving up and down at the same time. Negative correlation is when it moves exactly opposite, exactly. Randomly is something different. Now, we look at the S&P, one-to-one correlation to itself. The NASDAQ to the S&P, 0.92, still a very high. Look down this entire list. There's a positive correlation. The entire list is positively correlated. Real estate is highly correlated. Commodities, not as high, but still positively correlated. EAFE, Europe, Australia, Far East, highly correlated. Emerging markets, highly correlated. The Bloomberg U.S. aggregate bonds are positively correlated, usually not positively correlated all the time, but this is a 10-year correlation. What's going on right now? This is very important. This is a typical correlation that you see. Lower correlation. Now let's skip ahead of what we've seen year to date. This year, 2020. Now I'm going to refresh you. I want to go back to the other one. This is typical. We have, look at these, very highly correlated, but except for the commodities index, bond index, not very correlated, a lower correlated positive, but lower. So it's more of a random. As you get to zero, it's more of a random movement. And global aggregate, again, bonds and TIPS bonds. Here we are here. Look at this. Unbelievable. This is unbelievable. So much so that I'm going to put permanent circles around this. I want you to see this. We have a very high correlation with the commodity index to the S&P 500. Look at this, a 0.77 on the bond index, 0.82 on the global bond index, TIPS, 0.8. In other words, everything is moving at the same time in the same direction. That's not normal by a long shot. And why diversification this year is not providing us a lot of protection? Why our buffers have failed to do the job they were supposed to do? 6 times out of 80. And here we are in one of those times. So in my opinion, I would say, is it going to be like this forever? No, let's not think linearly. Let's think otherwise, that this is an aberration. So what other risks do we have right now? Well, since our May 22nd webinar, here's the things that haven't changed. The COVID lockdowns are still there in China and on and off. But when they lock down, it's not like five people. It's like 20 million. Further escalations in the Russian-Ukraine war, conflict, or whatever you want to call it, are going on. Not a change there. Recessionary fears are still there. Supply chain disruptions to a degree, not as much as they were. They're starting to get a bit better, of course, and continual political divide in the U.S. New risks. This is important. Some things that we identified very recently. Central bank policy mistakes. No kidding. Central banks around the world, followed by, like a penguin, the Fed, diving in full head first into the rate hiking policy that they're doing, that seems like they're not going to get off it for some time. China, Taiwan, now we're talking about China saying, hey, you know what? We are not putting military or any kind of forceful intervention out of the question. Now, the U.S. just yesterday says, you know what? We're going to work with Taiwan to build some military equipment. That's not so good. UK fiscal policy errors, not questionable, but absolute. Pension system collapse. We saw some major issues last week. We saw that the Bank of England and the Central Bank of England had to work together the last few days for about a $10 billion bailout already over the policy misstep that Prime Minister Truss, only in about 45 days, and within that period of time, was able to pretty much bring European pension plans, their bonds to their knees with the stupidest economic policy than anyone ever heard of. Consumer sentiment destruction, of course, people are pretty down in the dumps with what's going on. So what's our outlook? That's the big issue with all this. So the global allocations we have over at Schwab, anybody that has Schwab portfolios, our value tilt is going to maintain. Our alternative blends are going to be maintained. We increased that and added some exposure in that area that is a pretty good non-correlated asset class. We're looking for non-correlation, as we just saw that chart a second ago that showed that everything is correlated. We need stuff outside the bounds. And we have some, but we added some more to that in the portfolio. Lower duration bonds, something we added a couple of 3 months ago. We really pushed bonds even lower on the maturity scale to bring up overall protection from degradation of the value due to interest rate hikes. And I should share with you, you could only imagine if you know what the bonds in these portfolios have done, you know, down this year, nothing compared to some of the longer bonds that are out there that are down 35, 40%. For the year, you know, some of the long-term bonds are down pretty significantly, which we don't hold those. We're going to bring back the risk to neutral from under-risk position eventually. So just hold on to that. It's not happening right now. We have under-risk, and as crazy as it sounds, we have under-risk in our equity exposure that has helped. And I know it may not seem like it helps to some people. You know, you're down 15%, 16%, 17% for the year. You're like, wait a minute, I thought it was a conservative portfolio. Yeah. But you can see that a 60-40 portfolio was down 21% and bonds aren't helping and we have some non-dollar denominated stuff. It's just nothing's working. So it's a relative discussion, much better than it could have been. You can't spend relative monies. You can only spend absolute. So I get it 100%, but that's what we're working on right now. In investology, very similar, rebalance back to the model though. Value tilt will remain, continued lower maturity bonds on that. And in our TDI, the Disciplined Investor Managed Growth Strategy, here's what's interesting. I'm going to give an approximation. And this is where some of the things have gone wonky this year. We're actually beating various indices. We're way ahead of the Qs. We're way ahead of NASDAQ. We're ahead of technology. We're ahead of pretty much the S&P 500, slightly behind the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But that portfolio, which is fully invested in stocks, has a big cash buffer in it. We're going to continue to do that. We are continuing to increase the criteria for stocks in there, rotate and rebalance every three months and seek opportunities where they exist. We've done some hedging and reverse hedging this year. Some of it's worked, some of it hasn't. That's why we stayed with all this quick movement in primarily cash buffer, which has been helpful. So that will continue on. And we know what we got there. So what we have there is what is expected, actually. So I'm going to open up some of these questions and answer some of these. Let me get to these. They're over here. We have this recorded, by the way. So anybody that wants to, feels the need to listen to this all over again, can do that. Let's see. Okay. Why do you think gold and precious metals are not working the way they're supposed to in a high inflationary environment? Is because of the strong dollar. Yeah, that's pretty much it. The dollar is just absolutely trouncing everything. And that has to do with the fact that we have an unequal amount of inflationary stomping going on around the world. The U.S. has been very active in their inflationary move to stomp out inflation. The rates that are coming up are significantly causing tightening policy in the U.S. Flight to safety to the dollar is very significant. And that's bringing up the dollar, thereby gold, which is being priced in our world, in dollars is falling. So it's a very strange situation. I mean, it's not terribly strange, but it's just not working at all the way it should. I don't want to get rid of it. Last time I got rid of energy positioning was just the worst time. I think that long-term it's fine. We just have to live through some of this agony right now with this. Next question, which commodity do you think will be in high demand in the next 10 years as a side effect of the current year war? Uranium, lithium, copper, natural gas. I think natural gas as a cleaner energy is going to be an important factor in this. I mean, we can't guess at this. You would hope, and this would be just a fool's errand, but you would hope that many of these governments would come to their senses and realize that nuclear is one of the most efficient clean energies out there. And that, you know, all this other stuff that we're trying to do with solar or wind or, you know, water turbine or wave, or I don't know, just think about all the different things that we have. Those are great, but there still is an opportunity in things like uranium. And barring our total, for those of you that know what I'm about to tell you, know what I'm the other people are going to be like, what are you talking about? For all the damage of the China syndrome, what Jack Lemmon did to all of us, right? That was just a movie. It's the equivalent of Jaws when swimming in the ocean. You know, we're all so afraid of nuclear energy because we saw this movie and there was this horrible situation in Fukushima as well as Chernobyl. Bad, bad situations. There's no question. That's awful, terrible, bad, bad. But for the most part, we can build safe nuclear reactors in places that are less populated and cause less problems. And the fact is, when we think about what do we want to do for our future and the future of our children, it seems to me that it is just a crazy thing that we're not doing certain things like that, that we're just so concerned with fossil fuel. It's become a thing. The fossil fuel has become a thing, right? It's become the green movement's become a thing. And really pressed by a lot of people that are not in the know and don't understand a lot of the other alternatives. So I think uranium could be something interesting. Lithium, of course. I mean, you're mentioning a lot of things like lithium, of course, is in batteries for you know, EVs, things of that nature. So all these are important. And I think as we go through, it's going to come back. Copper, of course, is you know, in everything we have for transmissibility of electricity. All these things are really important. I can't argue with any of those. Question is, apart from the U.S., is there any emerging market where we can see growth? The big thing with the emerging markets right now, again, is the same thing. Again, it's the dollar. They have been affected by the fact that it's you know, we could buy for them in cheaply, but their economy slow down and get a little wonky when we have the dollar doing what it's doing, interest rates, you know, moving up as fast as they are, and inflation. Some places in emerging markets have 100% inflation. I still think areas like Vietnam, well, we'll call it Asia, industrializing, emerging Asia. Even China right now, the big problem with China is COVID. So if they can figure that out, we're back off to the races again. Are they going to figure it out? I don't know. I don't know what the hell the problem is. I don't know why. Listen, they only had 5,000 deaths or 5,600 deaths from COVID, so supposedly. Just let's just go with the information we know. Whether it's true or not is a whole different discussion. But what we know is there's a 5,500 or 5,600 deaths from COVID. That's pretty good in a population as big as they are. They've done a great job at containing this whole thing. However, it would seem it's just going to create deaths over a much longer period of time. They'll probably add up to the same amount. And when they can, I mean, I hate to say this, you know, try to do a little bit better with the vaccines and figure out a way to stop this. Now, I've been to Asia. Many of you have also. I've been to Vietnam, very populated areas. China, ridiculous. If you've been to Shanghai, you feel like, you know, what's going on here? How is there actually so many people all around me all the time? If you ever try to get on a subway in Japan and you got the pushers, official people on the deck of the subway, pushing you, squeezing you into the subway car. It's a true thing. It happens all the time, by the way. This is normal. This is a situation that is, you know, once you get a pandemic released in an area like that, it spreads very, very quickly. You think it spread quickly in the U.S.? Forget about it. In those countries, a lot worse. People are just on top of each other all the time. So I am not giving the thumbs up by any means to the COVID zero or the zero COVID policy over there. Something has to be done, though, because their economy is really having a lot of problems due to that. Emerging markets, emerging Asia, I think is really good. Emerging Europe, under the situation right now with the war is a problem. But I think on the back end of all this, we're going to see them really outperform the U.S. In the future. It's just an inevitability that we've seen from a cyclical nature of what happens. It just happens. And sometimes we have to take that belief that, you know, while there's this slowdown or a comparative performance that is in the benefit of or advantage of one place or another, usually that turns around in a couple of years. We saw that in that one table where, you know, you have this down year or two, and then all of a sudden it bounces back very quickly. Reversion of the mean is a big thing when it comes to investing, and it happens. All right, next question. Does crypto have any future? Wasn't crypto supposed to be safe haven in case high inflationary? That's a great question. I don't get it. I mean, I own some. We have very little to no exposure for our global allocations clients in anything related to crypto, especially the NFTs or altcoins, things of that nature. And my investment in it is just, to be honest with you, was just, here's some money. If I lose it, I don't care. And that sounds awful. But I'm like, I said, you know what? I'll put it in whatever happens. It's good. Not a lot of money. But the idea was it for be a separate asset class that was exempt from the movement of the dollar or inflation, or maybe even clear of government being able to seize it, or, you know, or even track, or anybody to track it to begin with. I mean, all that, right? I'm calling BS on this whole thing. It's a bunch of kids that got together thinking that they could change the world by doing something outside the boundaries. There is no way. I'm telling you right now, there is no way that the government of the United States, forget anybody else, the government of the United States is going to allow for the Bitcoin to become the legal tenor of the United States. We saw the failure in El Salvador. We've seen that the failure of it to maintain a constant value. And those, you know, total Bitcoiners or crypto bros will tell you, well, one Bitcoin is worth one Bitcoin. Okay, that's great. What does that even mean? I still can't buy as much as I did before. So what's the point? It has to be converted. Well, if a car was priced at one Bitcoin, it's still priced at one Bitcoin. No, it's not. The car price goes up. They want more than one Bitcoin. It's a bunch of terrible garbage. Is there a place for it in the world? Possibly. More so a digital currency, which we got. It was like, oh, we could use digital currency. I don't care who you are listening right now. I bet you use digital currency. And you're saying to me, what are you talking about, Andrew? I don't use digital currency. Wait a minute. I have none of this. Do you use a credit card? Use digital currency. It's basically a digital transaction paying for something. Let's call it plastic for what it is. Now, when it comes into your account, it has to be paid. Your choice right now is a multitude of ways to pay it. You're going to pay it with dollars. Okay. That digital currency had to be converted. So the digital currency is Visa card bill. We'll call it the Visa coin. Let's call it the Visa coin. You're using the Visa coin to pay things. That's being instantly converted to dollars to pay the merchant. And when it comes in, you pay it back. That's all it is. Think about when you use Venmo or Zelle, or you do a wire transaction. It's digitized, but it's a dollar. Now they're talking about putting it on the blockchain and all that. I don't know. Things are working just fine. You want less friction? Man, I can send money all around town on the snap of a finger. If anybody called me up right now and said, hey, Andrew, you owe me $20. I say, how do I pay you? They say, well, can you Venmo me? Can you Zelle me? Done. 2 seconds later, it's done. Winds up right in their account. And you got other things like online versions of PayPal or TransferWise. I work with some people for, we have some digital designers and website developers that are in India. They need money. They send me a bill. It converts immediately when I do through a company called TransferWise. It sends it. It authenticates it. Bank account, done within 30 seconds. Used to have to use Western Union, and they had to go pick it up at the Western Union office, and the fees were absurd. So hopefully that answered that question. Got a couple more, and then we'll wrap it up. What are my thoughts on housing? How much further down will we see housing prices go? You know, it's funny. If you bought a house within 2 years, 2 years ago, and your house is up substantially, 40%, so even a knockdown of 20% of your house price, like, that's cool. I mean, if my house price went down 20%, I'd be like, wow, that's it? It doubled when I bought it from 6 years ago. Well, right now, it's a triple. My house, not because I'm any smarter than anybody else, bought a house. It's three times the value, give or take a little bit, three times the value that it was, or at the height, it was three times the value, I should say, that it was in 2014, to be exact, 8 years ago. So where we are now, if it drops down 20%, so let's think about that. So that means that I'm still double 2.3% higher, or 2.3 times higher than it was, which I think is still incredible. Now, people that bought houses very recently and mortgaged it up 100% and now are wondering about moving and can't do so because of the fact that housing prices are down, I think housing prices should come down. Here's the point about housing. A lot of people are saying, well, housing is very strong. it's not going to come down very much because there's a major, well, yes and no. Housing prices probably will stabilize a bit in terms of new housing because the costs have come down dramatically and demand is a little bit less. Okay. The very nature that interest rates went from the beginning of last year at 2.75, we'll call it 3% at the end of last year for a mortgage, to 7% now, caused a major headache for people that are buying a house. For every $100,000 just on interest rate, just on interest alone, we're talking about a 4% differential. That's $4,000 a year. That's $350 a month extra that you have to pay to buy a house. Therefore, you can't buy a house with that much of a price. So what's going to happen? You're not going to buy a house. You'll buy something for less money. How do you buy something for less money? Well, you either wait it out and prices come down, or you go somewhere entirely different to do so. You go somewhere entirely different to do so. The house that you wanted probably doesn't have as many buyers as it had been before. That line that people stood outside banging down the door with wheelbarrows of cash, saying that they're going to name their first kid after you if you let them buy their house, probably not going to go on for a while longer, if it's going on at all. So I think that I don't know how much further down do we have. I think the differential that we saw from the year 2006, 2009, was that there was leverage upon leverage upon leverage upon bets upon leverage upon bets that was allowed to be done on the housing market. That was a problem. Different today, much higher criteria. Problem we have right now is that we have things like Airbnb. People bought houses, second houses, hoping that they could utilize the funds from operations like a hotel to fund that house. And therefore, that may be a problem if the property values come down. But yet at the same time, they're worried that they want to get out of it because they don't want to lose money. They could bring down some of the property values in neighborhoods due to the fact that they're really not holders that are living in the house, rather investors, which are the weakest hands when it comes to all this and starts the cavalcade and the cascade of pricing. The second thing that you have to worry about is that what we're seeing already is houses are longer on the market. Prices are starting to be cut a bit. I think that people will get scared. You'll start to see more housing for sale or house for sale signs on the front lawn. People wait way too long, get way too greedy, and decide that, you know what? They're not going to be the first schmuck to sell these prices. They're going to get a lot higher. And then all of a sudden, like, I'm not selling. Oh my God, I got to sell. And they start lowering prices. And everybody starts lowering prices because, oh my God, I got to get out. It's just the behavioral finance part of the cycle. I don't know the answer to that, how much further, but they should come down a bit. They need to stabilize. Certain areas around the country will be better than others. I think the Sun Belt, if you will, is going to be better than, I'm not picking on Idaho, but Idaho or some of the colder areas, Wisconsin, that maybe people don't want to live necessarily, where you can be remote work from an area that has lower taxes and has sunshine and decent weather. Not sunshine today here. It's raining and it's 64, by the way. Yeah. Raining now, 64. All right. Last question. This is a great question. This is really an important question. What do you mean by bonds are skewed to the short end? Higher yields mean lower demand. No. So the big issue there, what I was talking about, is our bonds in our portfolio are skewed to the lower maturities. In other words, you know, somewhere from we'll say zero, but that's the lowest maturity, but 1 year to 5 years, 4 years. When you look at bonds, they have an inverse relationship to price and yield. So what happens right now is as yield is coming up, prices are going down, right? Yield's coming up, price going down. Opposite of what we saw from 2009 through 2020. So the fulcrum point of that is longer. So if you think about a seesaw, even though you have things, let's take a pen. Okay, seesaw is moving. What's moving more? Is the center moving more or the ends? The ends are moving more, right? The ends are moving a lot more. Well, that's the longest dated bonds are going to see the greatest price movement as opposed to the shortest date, which is in the middle. It's a bit of relative. You could see movement, but it's going to be less and less extensive in the shorter dated. So higher yields, what we have is meaning lower demand. So when we have people not wanting to buy those bonds and they're selling those bonds where there's no demand, means yields go higher. Prices go down. What we're looking for is people to say, you know what, willing to buy those bonds right now, and they're not really doing that yet. Yields are still creeping higher. yielded 4.1% on the 10-year today, was above the closing price that we saw so far in this cycle, and that's a problem. Only a slight move, only a 0.1% move, but enough to make markets a little unhappy. So the fact is we want to stay skewed towards the lower maturity bonds that have, right, the fulcrum point somewhere here. That's where we want to be. So we don't see the big swings. However, there'll be a point that what we want to do is we want to get back on the bandwagon, lengthen ourselves out. If in fact people start buying bonds, right? They start buying bonds, what happens? Yields will come down and prices will start moving higher. Let's get on that bandwagon eventually if we see that happening, particularly if in fact we see the Fed having to reduce rates in 2023. So, or they start to slow down. That's when we start to lengthen our bonds out again. So we're on the watch for that. All right, again, we're going to have this recorded. Thank you so much for joining me.
And there you have it. Entire Q&A, commentary, outlook, review of what we see happening over the next several months. And if you notice at the end there, if you're still alive and awake, at the end, we talked about this whole discussion right there about, well, if there's a pivot. And that's what we started the discussion today with of what we saw this week with the Fed. So very interesting that we're already starting to see some inklings of the idea that maybe the Fed is slowing their process of raising interest rates because they do want to do hopefully the right thing and to see how the economy is going before they do a lot more. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed that. I hope it was helpful. Again, I'll mention you can get the information to follow along the presentation over on the Disciplined Investment, thedisciplinedinvestor.com. You can download it on the show notes for episode 787. If you have any questions about your own portfolio, now is the time before the end of the year. Let's take a look at what's going on for you. Let's see if we can work together and figure out a way to optimize what you're doing. Thank you so much for joining me this week and every week. I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.